Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. The horse race between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama is now so close it may be decided not by the voters in the primaries and caucuses, but by the Democratic Party's superdelegates, the party's free agent elites, who may have to break a virtual tie. For a party stung by Bush versus Gore and what many believed was a stolen election, it could get ugly. This hour, On Point, democracy, the Democrats, and the superdelegates. Joining me now from Washington is Matt Bai, political writer for the New York Times Magazine. He's author of The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. Matt, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Many people may not fully understand the role of superdelegates. Well, tell us how they have the power to influence this election.
Basically, the deal is that after 1980 or so, after a couple of elections in which the primary system had led to ordinary voters, choosing or nearly choosing candidates in the Democratic primary process that the powerful people inside the party were not entirely happy with, they set up this system called superdelegates, and basically that's about 15% of the total delegates. This year it's 796. And they are basically there are three groups. They are elected officials in Washington, in Congress, and in the states, mayors, governors. They are national committee people. In other words, the people from all the states who sit on the national committee, the Democratic National Committee. And then there are a bunch of at-large, about 75 at-large delegates, who are basically appointed by the chairman, in this case Howard Dean, and ratified by the national committee. All of these people have a vote effectively as free agents. In other words, they don't have to follow any voter verdict. They can vote for whoever they want. This has been an issue once before in 1984. It enabled Walter Mondale to dispatch of Gary Hart because, although he didn't need the superdelegates to put him over, his margin was safe because Hart didn't have really any of the superdelegates and therefore could not challenge him. And it's very, very likely to become an issue again this year because neither candidate is likely to have the 2025 delegates necessary to preclude, you know, further voting by the time the nomination has to be settled.
So the key to the victory is those 796-95 votes, the superdelegates.
Yes, and really, we're talking about an uncommitted. It's really, I think, more like about 300. In other words, many of the superdelegates have already committed one way or the other and can basically be counted. They can switch. They can certainly change their minds, and I think a lot of them might. But I think the particular focus now is on, you know, maybe half of the total delegates or less who have remained uncommitted to this point.
So who's ahead in the superdelegate count right now?
Well, I mean, we're guessing because I certainly don't have a breakdown. I haven't called them all, but they don't have to report it anywhere. But I think, you know, it's pretty clear that Hillary Clinton is ahead in the superdelegate count. But that's not really the central question, in a sense. The central question is how many superdelegates does it take for her, if she's behind in the delegate count, to overturn the voters? Because, she is the establishment candidate, and you would have expected her all along to get more of the votes in Washington, more of the votes among sort of party regulars. The question is, as she falls further behind in the delegate count, she's only behind by a little bit, but she's lost several straight races. She's got a tough one coming up in Wisconsin. And then in Ohio and Texas, which are the big states on March 4th, it'd be very difficult for her to pile up margins because she'd have to win by quite a bit. Otherwise, they're basically going to split the delegates. So at the end of the day, if she's looking at a deficit of, 100 delegates or 50 delegates or whatever it is, she has to not only win the superdelegates, she has to win them by a big enough margin. Enough of them have to be willing to weigh in here against the pledge delegate count in order to overturn what is effectively a very narrow verdict from the voters. Mm.
So with that as a backdrop, describe the amount of lobbying that's going on now among these superdelegates, Matt.
Well, there's an extensive amount of lobbying, as you might expect. Both campaigns have been working the superdelegates long before now. I mean, this has only become a topic of discussion, but they've been doing this for months. And you have, interestingly, I think you have in both campaigns people who've been doing this for decades who know this process well. I mean, Hillary Clinton has Harold Ickes, who was on the original committees, who was there when they created the superdelegates, who understands the system, who knows a lot of the people inside the party. I'm told that Obama's campaign has a guy named Jim Johnson, who you may recall from the 2004 campaign, who ran the vice presidential search for John Kerry. This is all being done very secretively, but I guarantee you, if you're a superdelegate, any superdelegate, for any reason, you have been called multiple times. You may have been called by both candidates. You may have been called by Bill Clinton. You may have been called by someone like a Ted Kennedy. You're being lobbied hard because those votes are gonna matter, and you're being lobbied in a different way because the two campaigns are proffering very different notions of what the superdelegate's responsibility actually is.
You had this image of superdelegates, it is sort of the wheeling and dealing in the smoky back room somewhere. Is that accurate? Is that what goes on?
It's a little bit accurate. I mean, it would be wrong to say no. That's completely accurate. I mean, there are a lot of congressmen, senators, mayors, governors, machine politicians. There are a lot of folks high up in the party who are going to make this decision based on the kinds of jobs they might get, or the loyalties they have, or the friends they share. I mean, absolutely. And I guess that's, you know, that they may not be smoking cigars, but that's pretty much what you think of when you think of back room. But there's also an awful lot of people who sit on the National Committee who are in their 20s or 30s, or who've been rewarded for activism, who've been out there knocking on doors for years and years and were able to get seats as superdelegates. I mean, you've got top union officials in Washington, and then you've got, you know, folks who've been door knocking in Ohio or Missouri. So it's a very mixed group. And the question here, as I say, really is, what is their responsibility? I mean, the Obama people are telling them that their responsibility is to ratify the will of the voters. The Clinton people are telling them that their responsibility is to choose who they think the best president would be. And frankly, I don't think there's any question here in my mind that the Clinton people are expressing the true intent of the superdelegates. It may not be pretty, but the superdelegates were not created to ratify the will of the voters. They were, in fact, created to thwart the will of the voters, if need be.
Well, let me take that one step further. And if you outline for us the nightmare scenario for the Democrats, if one candidate, as you say, gets more elected delegates, more states won, is ahead in the popular vote, but the superdelegate vote essentially hands the other candidate the nomination, what does that do to the party? What does that say about our process?
Well, you know, that's the rules, and that's the way it was set up. You know, parties aren't this isn't the government. This is a political party. It's a club, and it made its own rules, and those were the rules, and they were set up to do exactly that. The superdelegates were. I mean, Elaine Kmark may tell you otherwise. I don't think she will. She knows this as well as anyone. But they were chosen. The superdelegates were created, in effect, as a bulwark against the voters, and if need be, to reverse that decision. And when that was done in 1982, I think we lived in a little bit of a different society. I mean, I think that was a point where institutional power was still a greater force, and people were a little less empowered. This is pre-internet, pre a lot of the technology we're used to now. And I think memberships were more important, and people were more apt to follow the lead of institutional leaders. Now, I think it is a little dicier now because I think people are less inclined to trust authority, less inclined to trust institutions. We expect to be free agents. We make a lot more decisions. We have a lot more options in the products and the services we buy, and we make a lot more personalized decisions about them. And I think that there would be a considerable amount of consternation if that were the case. But it is absolutely within the rules.
Matt Bai is a political writer for the New York Times Magazine. Matt, thanks so much for your time today.
Anytime. Thanks, Jane.
Thank you. Joined us from Washington. We'll hear today from Democrats on both sides of the Obama-Clinton divide. Joining me first from NPR Studios in New York is Elaine Kmark, a lecturer at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and a superdelegate supporting Hillary Clinton. She's an expert on party politics and has worked both in the White House under Bill Clinton and for Al Gore's presidential campaign. She's author of The End of Government as We Know It. Elaine, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
So you just heard Matt Bai explain some of what superdelegates do. Based on what he said and from your research, extensive research, what is the role of a superdelegate?
I think Matt did a pretty good job on it. I was on the Hunt Commission, as was Harold Ickes, and I think it's important to put the superdelegates a little bit in the historical context. The Hunt Commission met in 1982 after the very, very divisive Carter-Kennedy convention fight, which really hurt Jimmy Carter's general election prospects enormously. And during that fight, the congressmen, senators, and national committee people were not on the floor of the convention because members of Congress didn't want to run against their own constituents to be delegates to the convention. So at a point when the party really needed leadership and really needed people to help pull them together, the people most likely to fill those roles were absent. I don't think that the discussion was really about having the superdelegates make sure they were at the convention for ballast and leadership, particularly if the convention ended up in a kind of very vicious fight the way the Carter Kennedy convention did end up. So they were very much meant to be there as a kind of safety valve.
A safety valve, but should superdelegates be in a position to trump elected delegates? The will of and the voice of the people?
Well, the one thing I would say about that is remember that every superdelegate is elected in some way or another. So people who are elected to office are pretty careful about going against the will of the voters. And so it seems to me that this would not be a sort of capricious decision that, oh, dear, we just don't like this candidate. We're going to go against them and change the will of the voters. Most superdelegates are watching very carefully this race. Most of them are hoping that the primaries will settle this, and they won't even have to get into that situation.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about democracy and the Democratic Party and the brewing controversy over superdelegates and their role in the presidential race. At the top here, I'd like to take a listen to some sound from yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation, where Barack Obama's chief political strategist, David Axelrod, said superdelegates should not, quote, leap over the will of the people in a single bound, end quote. Hillary Clinton's communications director, Howard Wolfson, and Axelrod then debate the issue.
The truth is that the math is the math, and right now Senator Obama has a strong lead, and we'd hate to see that lead. I agree with Speaker Pelosi. That should not be overturned. If at the end of the day we have that lead, that verdict should not be overturned by party insiders. Well, I don't think that will happen.
We are joined today by Elaine Kmark, a lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a superdelegate for Hillary Clinton. She served in the Clinton White House and worked for Al Gore's 2000 campaign. So based on what you just heard, Elaine, apparently Hillary Clinton says superdelegates should be free to choose the best qualified candidate. And Barack Obama says that superdelegates should be bound by the voters' will. Who's right?
Well, legally and historically, superdelegates are free to do whatever they want to. That's why they were created in the first place. And they were created to make sure that these party leaders were on the floor of the convention helping to guide the party towards a victory in November. Again, because they are all politicians, it's hard to imagine a scenario where they, quote, overturn the will of the voters.
Really?
Yeah, very hard. I mean, if there's a clear leader going into the convention who's won the most popular votes and won lots of delegates, you know, the superdelegates in the past have always simply ratified the will of the people. I think what's making this a very interesting debate this time around is that there is the high likelihood that this will continue through June in a very, very close race. And if it's very close, then, in fact, the superdelegates will have to step up to the plate and make some decisions about who they think the best nominee is.
Do you think that there might be some sort of settlement then before the convention for the sake of the party, given how divisive it would be for Democrats?
Well, we certainly hope so. And there's two historical models that I think would be interesting to our listeners. In 1984, Walter Mondale won the most votes, the most primaries against Gary Hart. But at the end of the day, he did not have quite enough to give him a working majority in the convention. And the superdelegates and the uncommitteds put him over the top and allowed him to have a working majority at the convention. In 1980, Carter and Kennedy had a very tough fought race that went all the way to the end. Kennedy was somewhat behind Carter in delegates, a couple hundred delegates, and he decided to take that fight all the way through the summer, all the way to the convention, in an effort to try and overturn Carter's lead at the convention. That was extremely divisive. Now, there were no superdelegates in those days. That was an extremely divisive convention, and many people thought it was sad that it happened, and that's why they invented the superdelegates in the first place, to try and have people that could kind of avoid that sort of train wreck again.
You mentioned Gary Hart. I'd like to welcome him now from Denver, Colorado, former U.S. Senator and two-time presidential candidate Gary Hart. He served as senator from Colorado from 1975 to 1987. His 1984 bid for the White House was ended when superdelegates, as Elaine mentioned, put Walter Mondale over the top for the nomination. He's now a professor of public affairs at the University of Colorado and author of the forthcoming book, Under the Eagle's Wing, A National Security Strategy, 2009. He is supporting Barack Obama, by the way. Senator Hart, good to have you back. Welcome.
Great pleasure. I must take issue with my friend Ms. Kmark on what happened in 84.
Well, set the record straight for us. What happened?
The fact of the matter is that Vice President Mondale and I pretty much won exactly the same number of primaries and caucuses. I know there is a tendency these days to shove caucuses aside. I won 25 or 26 states. I may have even won one more than he did. And the total number of votes cast was about the same. The fact of the matter is most of the superdelegates had pre-endorsed Vice President Mondale on a theory of inevitability. He was way ahead of everyone else before New Hampshire. And when it came time to make a decision, a number of them said they would have supported me if they didn't feel bound to him. So I think, contrary to what the mythology is today, and I have a letter in the New York Times this morning on the same subject, the superdelegates decided who the nominee should be, and the polls the weekend before the convention in San Francisco showed Vice President Mondale, I think, 12 or 15 points behind President Reagan, and I was 4 or 5 points behind.
So given all that, I suppose you think this is not a fair system. What do you do to change it?
Well, it's a complicated system because what you're trying to do is give the party establishment a voice at the convention, but without giving them a determinative voice. What's going to be scary here, and people are already talking about it, is if Senator Obama, or indeed Senator Clinton, has a slight lead. I think Elaine mentioned earlier a determinative lead or a definitive lead. What if it's 20 votes and the superdelegates, and neither has a majority? Then the superdelegates are going to have to decide. Mm. And what are they going to do?
Mm-hmm. And what about the voters in this case who've turned out this election so far in record numbers? How do they react if the perception is that something's happened in a back room by the elite or the big shots or those that are well-connected? How does that play to the party then going into the general election in November?
Won't be good. I think you can already see the blogs and letters to editors saying for whatever reason, particularly aimed at Senator Clinton or the Clintons, if this nomination is stolen, I'm going to vote for McCain. Now, that could well be just hollow threats. Who knows? But there is a strong resistance when you have an insurgent candidate like Senator Obama by people who think the party establishment sticks together and nominates its own. Again, back to my own situation, I campaigned for Vice President Mondale. I did over 50 events with and for him, but I simply couldn't deliver, if you will, the independent and young voters who had supported me.
What are the Democratic sensitivities, Senator Hart, at this point, after Al Gore's loss in the 2000 election and what many believed was a stolen election? What are the sensitivities then, playing by the rules this time around within the own party structure?
One thing to play by the rules, another thing to manipulate. And also the problem with the superdelegates is so much of it is not transparent. It's phone calls from President Clinton or somebody else for that matter, both ways. This is behind the scenes pressure and appeals and so forth. It is not transparent. It is not out in the open, and that's what turns people off.
At what point? Yes, Elaine, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, this feeling that there's a back room out there and there's something sneaky going on just doesn't match modern American politics. And I want to give you some proof of that. In the 2 weeks since this has been a major issue and people have suddenly discovered superdelegates, the superdelegate count itself has barely moved. In other words, what the superdelegates are obviously doing, the ones who remain uncommitted, is they are waiting to see what happens in Wisconsin, what happens in Ohio, what happens in Texas, and what happens in Pennsylvania. So there's no evidence. I mean, people are calling them, of course. Bill Clinton is calling them. Barack Obama is calling them. But frankly, I mean, there's a national committee woman in Massachusetts, my friend Debbie, and she had a long talk with President Clinton, and she said to President Clinton, I'm going to wait and see what the voters do. So there isn't this huge rush among the party, quote, insiders. There are no more back rooms. Gary Hart, you in your youth with the McGovern campaign and then the McGovern-Fraser reforms made sure that there were no more back rooms in American politics anymore.
Do you really believe that? Do you think the American people really believe that, Gary Hart?
Well, it's a symbol, and of course not. It's not a bunch of old, fat, bald-headed men smoking cigars making deals. But it is not transparent. That is to say, President Clinton has an advantage of Mrs. Clinton of saying, look, we had you in the White House to dinner. We gave your husband a job or your wife a job. We've been friends of yours. We raised money for you. Of course, that's the way politics works. But people don't – people resist ordinary people resist that. It sounds too much like old arrangements, old deals, old favors, and politics as usual.
Let's go to the phones at this point, get some thoughts from our listeners. From Providence, Rhode Island, Emma is on the line. Emma, go ahead. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Good. Welcome. Thanks.
Thanks. I just wanted to say two things. The first was that I am, and always have been, actually, since I first voted in my first presidential election for Bill Clinton, a Democrat. And I've never seen anything like this. I'm so disappointed in the Democratic Party at this point. I am supporting Obama, and I want to pick up on something that Gary Hart just said, which is from watching the way that Hillary Clinton and her campaign has worked, especially the past month or so, I don't think I could bring myself to vote for her if she were to win because of the superdelegates. I just don't know what I would do because I just think she's so underhanded at this point. I mean, trying to get the primary results from Michigan and Florida included when she promised, along with all the other candidates, that they weren't going to count. And now, I mean, I absolutely believe that Bill Clinton is making all those phone calls and leaning on the superdelegates to vote for her. And I just don't think it's fair.
Emma, thanks so much for your call. Elaine, one thought from, I think, representative of many voters.
Well, I think that the thing for Emma and others to realize is that we have two or three more months of the voters having the preeminent role in this process. And I think it's just very, very unlikely and a little paranoid on everybody's part to think that the superdelegates are going to overturn a clear and unambiguous will of the voters. I think the only way this happens is if you get what will be a very unusual situation where essentially both candidates come into the convention is evenly matched on all important criterion, and then somebody has to break the tie. We have to get a winner. We have to get a nominee out of the convention. But we still have several months to go, and in those months, I think the voters are the most important people. And this superdelegate thing is kind of an interesting sidelight. It brings up a lot of, you know, anxiety, a lot of paranoia, but I don't think this is the main show. And my guess is the probabilities are it won't be the main show because the voters will pick a clear winner one way or the other. And obviously, I hope it's Senator Clinton and Gary hopes it's Senator Obama. But we've still got a lot of voters to hear from before we start creating this myth that somehow the superdelegates are going to change the election.
Gary Hart, I guess in this nomination process, with it being so close, and you mentioned that, that tight race, I would suspect the Democratic Party does not want some sort of internecine fight where one side is so bitter that the other side feels that they really can't support the winner.
Well, there is a myth. Talk about myths. There is a myth that there's something called the Democratic Party. Elaine would be the first to admit that there is no such thing. There is a man
Good
called
point.
There's a man called Howard Dean in Washington, and something called the DNC. And other than that, there is no Democratic
right.
Party. I mean, in the sense of a whole bunch, you know, a bunch of people getting together and saying, okay, here's what we're going to do. I've always kind of envied the Republican, the corporate party with a small c, which up to now has been much more able to speak with one voice. But there is no Democratic Party in the sense you're using that. I think most active Democrats who want to win this election do not want a divisive contest. But and of course, Ms. Kamark's formulation is correct. If it's clear and unambiguous, then we're wasting our time with this conversation. What we're anticipating, and a lot of people spend a lot of time on the math, is a contest in which we get to Denver, by the way, in August, and there is no more than 100 delegates separating the two, and maybe fewer than 50. That's when it's going to be contentious.
Back to the phones before we go to our next break. Robert is calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Robert, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question. Under the circumstance where perhaps it's even fairly evenly divided among the superdelegates, do you think it's a possibility that the Democratic Party could actually go ahead and decide to accept Michigan and Florida's votes?
Michigan and Florida's votes, right. Another important issue,
yeah.
Elaine Kamark and Gary Hart. Just for some background, the Democratic National Committee penalized Florida and Michigan for holding their primaries earlier than the party wanted them, stripped them of their delegates to the convention. So that is backdrop for Robert's question. Should the Democratic Party allow their delegates into the convention? Gary Hart?
I think this is the, by the way, I think this is the more contentious question than the superdelegates, because that we need those two states in the fall, and a lot of people believe if there are not delegations from those two states, we forfeit them in the general election. Now, that may or may not be the case, but it certainly makes it a tougher uphill struggle, because the Republicans will simply say to people in those two states, the Democrats didn't want you in their convention, so vote for us. And those are two important states. I think Chairman Dean has to be sitting down with some gray beards or gray hairs so that we have Elaine there. No.
Thank you, Gary.
Did I walk into that?
Yep.
I haven't seen Elaine in a year or two, and she didn't have a gray hair in her head. So I take
nor a beard.
Well, that's what I was floundering to try to get out. Okay, you get my point. Senior experienced Democrats, and say let's work out the scenario where we have delegations, seat delegations, and it's fair to everyone else. That's going to be tough.
I've got about 30 seconds before the break. Elaine, chime in. Florida and Michigan,
I was on the Rules Committee when we decided to strip them of their delegates, and the biggest worry was the general election effect. Interestingly enough, when the Republicans cut their delegations in half, we knew that the Republican Party was very grateful to us for stopping massive confusion in the primary system. And so far, knock on wood, they have not used this against us in those states. And I'm hoping that we can settle it, as Gary said, and have them with us in the fall.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the Clinton-Obama contest for the White House and the role that superdelegates may play in deciding that race. We're joined today from Denver by former Senator Gary Hart, a two-time presidential candidate and professor at the University of Colorado. He's an Obama supporter. And from NPR studios in New York City, we're joined by Elaine Kmark, lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a superdelegate for Hillary Clinton. I'd like to take a listen now to the senator, Senator Hillary Clinton. Earlier this month, she said that superdelegates should have, quote, independence of judgment. Here is her statement, courtesy of MSNBC.
We've got a system. We're following that system. A lot of superdelegates have independent judgment about who can win and who can be the best president. I respect their judgment. Oftentimes, they have firsthand knowledge of the candidates. So historically, independence has been part of what we've looked for from the superdelegates.
So, Elaine Kmark and Gary Hart, I'd like to ask you about that comment in relation to Florida and Michigan, where Hillary Clinton once supported and accepted the Democratic National Committee ruling that the votes from those places would not be counted. And now, as it turns out that she got more votes in those states, she says that she wants those votes counted. Is that fair, Elaine?
Well, I think it's difficult. I think it's a difficult argument to make. I was on the Rules Committee, as I said before the break, and we really did help prevent a lot of confusion in the primary process by taking the actions we did on Florida and Michigan. And the Republicans were grateful for it, and the whole rest of this country was, because the primary system was careening out of control as states were threatening to have their primaries at Christmas and Thanksgiving, and nobody wanted that. So this is a very difficult situation. Traditionally, states that whose delegations are under challenge are not allowed to vote on their own credentials challenge. So for this to happen, there would have to be a very comfortable majority by one side or the other, in this instance by the Hillary campaign. And I suspect that if this happened, it would be for the purposes of looking forward to the general election and trying to make peace with those two states and make sure that it wasn't a general election issue. I think it's very difficult for this issue to affect the nomination if it's a close race.
Senator Hart, is a do-over caucus, if you will, in Michigan and Florida the answer, where Obama can compete with Clinton fairly?
That's certainly one option. Some mathematical formula based on total votes in other primaries, I suppose, would be another, or total earned delegates from the entire process, apportioned accordingly in those two states, would be another. One of the myths of 72, by the way, I'm getting to be an old codger, was that Mayor Daley and people like him were shut out. I happen to have personally negotiated a proposal with the Reform delegation headed by two young activists, one called Jesse Jackson, which followed the McGovern reform rules, and the party regulars, which did not, of seating both delegations with half votes each. So we did try to get Mayor Daley at that convention, and he turned the deal down. It was all or nothing for him. That may or may not be relevant here, but it does suggest that even in the face of some pretty strong rules by the National Committee, terms can be arranged, but they have to be certainly, again, transparent and fair with both campaigns.
Callers, hold on for a moment. I'll get to you, I promise, but I want to add another voice to the conversation here and hear from a big state that's holding a primary vote tomorrow, in fact. Joining us now from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is Congresswoman Gwen Moore, who has represented Wisconsin's 4th District since 2005. She sits on the House Budget Committee and is a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. She is a superdelegate supporting Barack Obama. Congresswoman Moore, good to have you with us today.
Oh,
thanks.
Great. And it's wonderful to have your guests, Elaine and Gary Hart. I think it's been a very great conversation, Jade.
Well, thank you. You're a superdelegate for Barack Obama, as I mentioned. You came out for him quite early in April of last year. Why did you decide so early before your constituents could weigh in?
I can tell you that I weighed in very early because Barack Obama's story and is so similar to my own political stewardship. I have been in the state senate, of course. I was in the state senate for state legislature for 16 years before I came to Congress, and I was an 18-year-old mother, just like his mom, and I saw Barack Obama as dealing with more family-friendly legislation than Hillary Clinton. And I early on thought that Barack Obama would best represent not only me but my constituents. Wisconsin was one of those states that ended support to women and poor children early on before it became a federal issue in 1996-97. And we have suffered tremendously. We're at the eighth highest poverty rate in the country, high unemployment and underemployment. Barack Obama definitely seemed to be a candidate that would best represent my constituents.
And so I guess then if your constituents come out and decide that Hillary Clinton is their choice, will you switch your vote as a superdelegate?
Well, I can tell you that I'm working very hard to make sure that I'm on the same page with my constituents, because I do see myself as being a representative and steward of the people. And I do think that that's presented a great deal of problems for folk. Now, my sense is that the 4th Congressional District here will go big for Obama. And I have seen it as my job as a representative to try to lay out reasons that I think that he would be best for our constituents. This is a manufacturing state, for one thing. We lost a tremendous number of jobs in this state. And stuff like NAFTA that occurred during the Clinton years has hurt Milwaukee tremendously.
Yeah.
So I, certainly we all want to come together at the end and vote for whoever the nominee is, but this is a primary. And in a primary, you try to align yourself with those candidates that best represent the interests of your constituents, and you try to get your constituents to agree with you. I would not want to be in the very untenable and uncomfortable position that some of the superdelegates are in.
Well, Donna Brazile, for one, a superdelegate and a grand dame of sorts in the Democratic Party, said she'd quit the party if the superdelegates override the voters.
I can tell you, it really does present quite a quagmire, because either the rules are the rules or the rules are not the rules. And I think that both Senator Obama and Senator Clinton can be hurt by the rules. The rules, for example, say that Michigan and Florida will not be seated. That, of course, as your guests have pointed out, may hurt the party in the general election. But at the same time, the rules say that these superdelegates can vote as they wish, which could hurt Barack Obama, for example. I mean, right now he's ahead in the popular vote. He seems to have an insurmountable lead in the pledged delegate count. And unless, Senator Clinton is able to pull off super duper landslides in the remaining states, which she hasn't done so far, it seems to me that Barack Obama would go into the convention with most pledged delegates. Now, the rules say that these superdelegates could be free to vote for whoever they want. So it does present quite a dilemma. I mean, we could...
there is a long way to go, that's for sure.
Lose the war.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? I got to go back to the phones now, because Tony's been waiting for a while. He's calling from Albany, New York. Tony, welcome to the program. Hello.
Yeah, I have a couple of comments. I think they should get rid of the superdelegates. If their point was to resolve issues, then they shouldn't have declared. It's 2-1 for Hillary, and there's no reason they should have made their positions known so soon. My other comment is that people keep talking about history as this is some sort of big historical event, these superdelegates. It's not. 20 years is not very historical basis for any kind of reasoning, and this is all about trust. And if this gets overturned, I mean, this is Hillary Clinton's biggest issue. You can't trust her. And if this gets overturned on this kind of issue, you know, the thing in Florida and her about agreeing to not accept the delegates, but now that she's behind, she wants them, it goes to the core of the issue, which is trust. And if this gets overturned and goes to Hillary over Obama, I'm not voting at all.
Tony, thank you for your call. Elaine, K. Mark, you hear it in his voice. There's a lot of people feeling that.
Yeah, and I just don't think it'll happen. I mean, I just see it very unlikely that there's a winner, a clear-cut winner out of the primary process, a clear-cut winner on the part of the voters, and that the superdelegates go and do something else. It's just not going to happen. And let me also point out that, frankly, at the end of the day, none of the delegates are bound. The party rule simply says that delegates shall, in all good conscience, vote for the person they were elected to represent.
That's the language, yeah.
That's the language. So in a very, very tight situation where they're evenly matched, you know, delegates can start changing their minds, too. The reason there's so much anxiety here is that it has been years and years and years since we had a convention that went beyond a first ballot. And probably the closest convention in modern history would be the 1976 Republicans, where Ford and Reagan walked into that convention almost exactly evenly matched on the delegate count. And there was a lot of maneuvering. So we're a little bit in uncharted territory. And I take Tony's point about talking about history, but we do it because that's the only way we can start to think about what might happen if, in fact, this is the voters don't end up making a decision.
Back to the phones now to Seabrook, New Hampshire. Phil is on the line. Hi, Phil. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Here's my suggestion. I think the superdelegates are a reality. Chairman Dean should establish the criteria by which they make their decision, which should be who of the two candidates best makes the case against John McCain between now and the convention. It would do two things. Number one, it would hopefully discipline and control the amount of backbiting that goes on between the two candidates, tearing each other down between now and then, and put the focus on how well they can carry the standard in the general election. But it would also start the process now of pointing out that this guy that they're now calling a great American and having sort of civil differences with him on policy, but calling him a great American and so forth, this guy is a dangerous, dangerous individual. His temperament, his mentality, the history of this guy going back to childhood should scare us to death. And
all right, Phil, I take your point, and I'm running out of time. I'm going to turn it over to Gary Hart and ask you to respond. Gary, do you have any thoughts, Senator Hart?
Well, I think two things are going on in a contest for the nomination. You're seeking to be the person who enters the general election and do what this caller says, defeat the other side. But you're also leader of the party, and therefore, in a contested nomination race, it's the party defining itself, and that's very much what's going on here. This is not left-right. This is like 84. It is future-past. And I can't extract myself from my own experience. As the party defines itself, it conditions whether or not it can win in the general election. I hate to say it again, but Vice President Mondale lost very badly. And with all due respect to Senator Clinton and Elaine and her supporters, there is a lot of fear on the part of many Democrats, and particularly activist insurgent Democrats, that the same thing might happen this year. We'll just have to see.
Back to Congresswoman Gwen Moore for a moment. Congresswoman, you're a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, and as you well know, Congressman John Lewis, who is a very influential Democrat, recently indicated that he's going to switch from Clinton to Obama. And I'm wondering what sorts of pressures there are in the Black Caucus, given Obama's historic candidacy, given Hillary Clinton's history with the African-American vote?
Well, I can tell you that, you know, John Lewis was informed by an actual vote. I think it was something like 80% of the vote in his district that voted for Barack Obama. And Senator Hart mentioned it earlier. People have long-term relationships with people and friendships with people, and I think that Congressman Lewis decided that that the will of his people ought to supersede his personal relationship with the Clintons, and that he ought to And he's a very honorable, noble man. And I think that other members of the Black Caucus, some of them have very good relationships with the Clintons. And they supported Hillary Clinton early on. And I don't think that they realized the kind of traction and appeal that Barack Obama would have. He was brand new. And so it would be left up to them. The Black Caucus does not typically endorse during primaries. And people are free to support whoever they want. And I think that that's what's happened.
I want to get to one last call before we slip out of this program here. Sumner is in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Sumner, welcome.
Hi.
I've got about 30 seconds. Can you make it quick, please?
I wanted to say very briefly that I do believe the superdelegates should decide. That would be following the rules. And the main reason is that the caucus state system is unfair because the elderly, people who are ill, the military, people who are out of state are disenfranchised. They cannot stand there. They cannot be there for 3 hours. They cannot stand for 3 hours. And as a result, voters in the caucus states are worth about 5,000 voters in primary states. So for that reason, at least, the superdelegates need to participate.
Sumner, thank you. Good point. Last 20 seconds each for Gary Hart, Senator Hart, and Elaine K. Mark. Senator, you first.
Well, I disagree about the last call. I come from a caucus state. Caucus states are party-building states, people who can and do take the trouble to come out, and there were about 1,000 up in the mountains where I live, build the party. They often stay involved. So unlike primary voters who come and go, caucus states are important, and they deserve equal treatment.
Elaine K. Mark, real quick.
Well, they all have equal treatment under the party rules, but I think the caller's point is well taken that primary states are a better indication of how powerful a candidate's appeal is in a broad swath of the electorate.
Fascinating conversation. I could go another hour. Thanks so much to all of you, Elaine K. Mark, Senator Gary Hart, Congresswoman Gwen Moore. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.